You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. The
what am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
Are you not entertained?
I don't know who you are.
Why so sick?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
If they call me Mr.
The boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You're gonna bark all day, little dog.
No way!
Everyone!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. I got out of the house on a Sunday for the first time in a minute, which was highly out of character for me, frankly. Otherwise, I don't know about you, podcast listener people that I don't know, but this is a weird week overall for me, and for some reason, most of my friends, well, not for some reason, for one reason or another. So I don't know if a planet was in the house of the rising sun or in the microwave or whatever, but this was a weird week. We actually all convened at the bar on Friday to lick our wounds like our forefathers before us. But there were board games too, because we're still young and fun. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got The First Omen. And I had this conversation with the guy who poured my wine at the movie theater. For some reason, there's just a shitload of devil movies, like especially like devil nun movies out right now. It's weird. And for some reason, my formerly Catholic ass can't seem to get enough of them because I've seen all of them. I've seen all the devil, nun movies, vampires don't count. But like, there's so many for whatever reason out in the theaters right now. And for some reason that I'm sure has something to do with going to a Catholic high school, it's the only movies I can drag myself to see. If you're going to see any of the Devil Baby movies that are out in theaters right now, I would say this is probably the best of them. Did we need a movie laying out how the Omen baby got here, aka Damien? Arguably not, but I enjoyed it overall. It's a touch too long, but everything these days seems to be for some reason, so what are you gonna do? They also low-key set up a franchise for this, or at least it felt that way. There's like an... Yeah, I won't spoil it. I was just about to spoil it. It's not going to blow your mind, but it's a serviceable horror movie overall with some pretty good horror elements. The Criterion pick of the week is Spine number 857, which is Before Sunrise, the first film in Richard Linklater's Before trilogy. This film has been on my shame list forever. That's the name I give the list of films that everyone's seen and loves, but I've never gotten around to actually seeing myself. I actually assumed I would love these movies so much, I banked on it so much, that I actually bought the physical copies from Criterion when they had a sale a couple of months ago. I just needed to like actually physically put it in a Blu-ray player. I could have rented it online, but I own the physical copy, so I'm not gonna do that. Dude... It never ceases to amaze me, like how many movies I've seen. If I go by my Letterboxd account, and I'm sure there's ones I haven't found on there to rate yet, I've seen probably over 4,000 or 5,000 movies in my lifetime. There's some of those are shorts, but it still counts. But like, it never ceases to amaze me just how much quality cinema is still out there that I haven't gotten my eyes on. Because holy crap, this movie was so goddamn good. It's just, it's a quiet film. It's very dialogue heavy. So, you know, make sure your Adderall's working. But it was beautiful. It's this beautiful movie about these two young people in Vienna over the course of an evening. My God, I cannot wait to watch the other two. I love how Richard Linklater plays with time in a lot of his movies. For example, he did Boyhood, the film that he famously took 12 years to make. And he's currently shooting a film based on the musical Merrily We Roll Along, which is going to take him like 20 years to shoot. Hopefully nobody dies in the process, I guess. But yeah, his ability to just take his time with movies. There's very few directors that are even going to be allowed to do this. So the fact that we get at least one, pretty great. So yeah, hopefully none of them die. And with that cheerful thought, on to this week's topic. This week, a brief look into the re-editing of movies for television and for in-flight entertainment, and why some directors opted to remove their name from these new edits, as well as the film that exposed Alan Smithy for the fraud he is, and what happened after. Also, you're about to hear some examples of TV dubbing right now. I feel like you kind of need an explanation for this first, like, break stuff. So enjoy the non-swearing and what they thought would be a good word to put in there instead. I'll explain what all of this is a little bit later. But with that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
I couldn't help but notice that you two groups of people are about to start killing each other, and I was wondering if you could please just wait on that until we could get off the train.
Sit down, witch.
Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
Hand me the keys, your fairy godmother.
Damn you, I'll walk.
Oh, what do you know, witch?
Turn this thing over.
Get your stuff.
Damn.
Get your stuff.
Damn you.
Step out of your mouth.
Crazy son of a witch.
What are you talking all that trash for? Go on, get out of here.
So we've spent the last few weeks going over films and situations that would make a director of some kind on a film want to remove their name from the credits. One thing we haven't touched on yet, though, is when a director makes a film which releases theatrically using their actual name, only to have the studio or the censors re-edit that film due to content, therefore altering the film. Several times in the past, this has led to a director requesting the Alan Smithy moniker for this new version. Their name stays on the original theatrical version, but for any re-edit, that credit goes to Alan Smithy. The first time this was allowed was for David Lynch's 1984 Dune adaptation. The film hadn't exactly been a runaway hit with critics or audiences, and the theatrical version had been massively cut down from its work print, which ran over 4 hours. A work print, if you don't know, is an edit that is assembled, usually by the editor, to directly mirror the shooting script of a film, and then the director comes in and kind of, you know, puts their spin on it. Lynch had wanted to whittle this down to about a 3-hour cut, but the studio, Universal once again, wanted a more digestible 2-hour runtime, which meant cutting the film effectively in half. Eventually, producer for the film Dino De Laurenti and his daughter Raffaella stepped in to get Lynch to cut several scenes while filming new ones to simplify the story. They also added voiceovers and the whole, if you've seen it, Princess, I think her name's Irulan? Exposition scene at the top. It's basically, if you've seen the new one, it's Florence Pugh's character, but obviously the 1984, I think it was Virginia Madsen. She's basically explaining like the whole Dune situation, like what is this place and why are these people like this? That's basically what they shot. So the runtime of this was about 2 hours and 20 minutes, which is ultimately what got released. 4 years after the film came out to disastrous reviews and it became a box office bomb despite the book's popularity, a TV version of the film premiered, which was split into 2 parts and that had a total runtime of just over 3 hours. The princess monologue at the top was gone, replaced by a lengthy explanation of the Dune universe that was accompanied by concept art from the film. Lynch disowned this version of the film, and because it was starkly different from his theatrical cut, he was allowed to be credited as Alan Smithy on this new version. There's a couple of other unofficial versions of Dune out there as well, including an edit by the film's international distributor Lionsgate that compiles elements from the theatrical and the television edit. As recently as last month, scenes are still being discovered and added to fan edits that float around the interwebs. Universal has since approached Lynch about the possibility of him coming back and doing a director's cut, likely to capitalize on the popularity of the Warner Brothers adaptation, but Lynch so far has refused. The idea, he's admitted in interviews, intrigues him, but he doesn't believe that there's enough footage left on the cutting room floor to make the film into what he'd really want it to be. Lynch also claimed that he was quote-unquote selling out when he made the film. Other people who took their names off of TV cuts of their films include William Friedkin, who took his name off of the 1990s supernatural horror film The Guardian for the television edit, though he spiced it up and used the name Alan Von Smithy. In 1992, director Martin Brest removed his name from the in-flight version of Scent of a Woman. In 1993, David Anspaugh did the same for the TV release of Rudy. And in 1995, Michael Mann used Alan Smithy for the TV edit for Heat. And frankly, I mean, is anybody looking at the credits of TV and airplane movies? I have never done that. And honestly, I could totally be blanking because I haven't admittedly watched cable TV in a long time. But the credits go by so damn fast. Like, can you even read? I don't know. It feels a little pedantic, but that's just me. Also, there's a disclaimer in front of films, especially back in the day when the films had to be reformatted for TVs, that the film has been altered for time and content and edited to fit the screen. They used to play in front of like every movie. It was like black screen, white text. Like, hey, it's different. It's the gist, but it is different. Like, who was watching cable TV or broadcast TV to be like, yes, this is cinema? I mean, yeah. Anyway. That's my 2 cents. Also, I might just not be remembering how TV worked 20 years ago because I've not had regular cable for about 14 years. Yeah, I haven't had cable for 14 years. To make some films, quote unquote, suitable for at least American broadcasts, I'm not super familiar with international TV rules. I know most of them are a little bit more liberal than ours are. And also to appeal to advertisers when a film is shown on ad-supported TV or basic cable. These alternative versions are created to get rid of the nudity, the sexy times, and swearing is removed or replaced. Often, the swears are substituted with words that match the lips through ADR. They hire voice actors that sound like the actors, by the way. It's most often not the actor on the screen. And people actually have, like, very lucrative careers doing this. They'll come in and say, like, the goofy word, and then they get paid a decent day rate for it. And if they don't do that, they're muted entirely, which, honestly, is what they should do anyway. The editing of these versions is typically performed by a censor and not the producer or director, which is why it's so easy for the directors to get a pseudonym slapped on it instead of their own name. The modern creative agreement for directors laid out in their current union contract actually states that a film that is under 2 hours in length cannot be re-edited for a flight, if you're interested about that kind of stuff. However, if it is over 2 hours, it can be re-edited to 2 hours. So, like, they can technically, I'm sure Dave, Christopher Nolan's got a stipulation in his contract that would not allow them to do this, but, like, they could, in theory, unless he has a stipulation in his contract saying that they can't, Universal could probably edit Oppenheimer down to 2 hours for airplanes. The way Nolan really wanted you to see it was on an airplane. Some honorable mention Alan Smithy films include 1990's Catch Fire, which was the actor Dennis Hopper's directorial debut. He would, however, restore his name to the credits in the 1992 director's cut of the film, which was renamed, ironically, Backtrack, that restored 18 minutes of footage. Actor Jeremy Renner's feature film debut, National Lampoon's Senior Trip from 1995, was ultimately credited to Alan Smithy. He was not the director, by the way. Kind of sounds, in that sense, like he was. He wasn't. I saw it like 10, 15 years ago whenever Hurt Locker was, is when I saw it. And it's horrific. That was actually probably where my basis for Alan Smithy came from, was that movie, because that movie's bad. So yeah, as you can probably see, there started to be an extreme influx of Smithy movies in the early 90s, with the first 4 or 5 years seeing more than any other decade combined, if you're counting the TV and plane edits. Given that some of these films had been directed by known people, then a different name was given to the TV airline version, there was a peek behind the curtain that was about to happen. And in short, the jig was up. Or it was about to be completely. And ironically, Alan Smithy may have been revealed by the most Alan Smithy film that we will discuss this month. That film was called an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn, and it was produced and written by one Joe Esteras. Esteras? I forgot to look it up. The film is about a man named Alan Smithy who directed a star-studded action film for a studio. He was hired because he was an editor and therefore inexperienced. The producers on the film assumed incorrectly that this would mean they could push him around, but not so. After some light hijinks, Smithy realizes that he's lost control of the film and decides he wants to use the DGA pseudonym as his credit. Just one problem, Alan Smithy's name is actually Alan Smithy. Pushed to the brink, the real Smithy steals the film and threatens to burn it on live TV. The producers of the film are desperate to track him down before he can actually do that. Smithy evades them, making friends with kooky film people along the way. That's the plot. Esteras was one of the most despised writer-producers in Hollywood throughout the 80s and 90s, as he was notorious for securing multi-million dollar contracts based on half-formed scripts that he pitched if he had a... One article I read described it as he would basically write down an idea on a cocktail napkin and a producer would pay for it. The dude ended up being the highest paid screenwriter of all time in the early 90s when he received a $3 million payday for his script Love Hurts that ultimately became the film Basic Instinct, which released in 1992. He would reportedly make at least a few more seven-figure paydays based on his scant outlines, but after the Alan Smithy film, he would not see that height again. In fact, it effectively ended his career, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Esteras' claim to fame was the 1983 film Flashdance, which is one of the highest-grossing films of that year. By the early 90s, he was specializing in erotic thriller scripts, primarily, which, in addition to Basic Instinct, would go on to include the film Showgirls that would earn, if you can call it that, Esterhus his first Golden Raspberry Award. If you don't know what that is, the Golden Raspberry is the award given during the Razzies, an award ceremony celebrating the worst in film for a given year. Typically, the ceremony actually occurs the night before the Oscars. Despite this, Showgirls at the time became one of the highest performing films ever for MGM, so that's how well that was all going. Ironically enough, the director for Showgirls, Paul Verhoeven, used the pseudonym Jan Jensen, which is a Dutch variation of Alan Smithy, for the television edit of Showgirls. Esterhus was super anal about his scripts, refusing actors or directors to alter his dialogue in any way. But as the year stretched on, people began to notice that an Esterhus script had a nasty habit of turning into an expensive flop. By the time Burn Hollywood Burn was written, Esterhus was already falling from grace and had decided to scribe a picture taking shots of the very people who had made him an obscenely wealthy dude. Directing Burn Hollywood Burn was Arthur Hiller, who most famously made Love Story back in 1970. Hiller had worked steadily since then, nothing terribly memorable, but he worked steadily. And the 90s, frankly, was a shadow of his former career. The highlights were far behind him. He was in his 70s. This is kind of to be expected, frankly, unless you're Martin Scorsese, who I think will just die on a film set. But yeah, as far as quality, so we've got like a bro guy who, you know, sells scripts in bars with half-formed ideas, and we've got a 70-year-old man running this film. So it should not come as a surprise to hear that this movie is dated beyond belief. It's sexist as hell. There's just childish name-calling happening throughout that is painfully cringy. Frankly, this is what I'd been expecting from an Alan Smithy film. Ironically enough, it's horrific. I couldn't finish it. Production-wise, the film ran out of money for music late into production, so Esterhus asked unsigned bands to submit music that he had to pay for personally to use in the film. He also took over post-production, re-editing the film against Hiller's wishes, and as a result, Hiller had his name removed and changed to Alan Smithy. Oh, the irony. Initially, people thought that this was a marketing gimmick for the movie, but when people saw it, they realized that it for sure was not. It was, in fact, trash. In his autobiography, Hollywood Animal, Esterhus would refute that Hiller was in the editing room with him the whole time. The DGA clearly disagreed because they let Hiller use Alan Smithy on the Alan Smithy film. Upon its release, Roger Ebert gave the film 0 stars, something he only did about 70 times out of his over 10,000 movie reviews. Ebert called it not just bad, but quote-unquote incompetent, and that the film also represented a lapse in judgment for Esterhus, who is, quote, sometimes a good writer. In 2005, Ebert included it on his list of most hated films. Burn Hollywood Burn bombed at the box office, too. The film had an estimated budget of about $10 million and grossed roughly $52,000. You don't have to be good at math to know that that is really bad. The film only made that much probably because it was only released in 19 theaters, but yeah, phenomenal bomb. Esterhus would, because of his participation in this film, become the first person to ever win 4 Golden Raspberries for a single film. This film effectively ended his career, and over the next 10 years, not a single one of his scripts was made. Since then, Esterhus has spent the better part of the last 3 decades writing memoirs for himself. He's also had a feud with Mel Gibson, but, you know, who hasn't? At the end of the day, Esterhus was a middlingly talented bro who managed to hack the studio system of the 90s for lucrative financial gains. What our eyes were bombarded with as a result was widely trashy, sexist mid-scripts that were by and large box office bombs. You're not going to learn too much about him in film school, let's put it that way. The intense negative publicity that surrounded Burn Hollywood Burn drew unwanted mainstream attention to the pseudonym Alan Smithy. As a result, the DGA effectively retired the name after actor Kiefer Sutherland used it to hide his direction of the 2000 film Woman Wanted. Alan Smithy was effectively dead. But never fear, Alan Smithy's descendants endure. For example, with the film Supernova from 2000, director Walter Hill was instead credited as Thomas Lee. A few years later, David O. Russell pulled his name from the film Accidental Love, which was credited to the fictional Stephen Green instead. Russell had effectively walked away from the production, which was originally called Nailed. When production had started, Russell was coming off the heels of three successful films, the most recent of which had been Three Kings. But he'd also recently taken a pretty major reputation hit due to the failure of the film I Heart Huckabees, coupled with a video taken on that set of him full-ass screaming and fighting with actress Lily Tomlin. Not physically fighting, but he definitely wanted to hit her. Like, you can tell. Like, he was pissed. It's on the internet. You can find it. So he really needed Nailed to go well, and it did not. Shooting started in 2008, but was stopped on the first day of production because of money issues. It turned out that Russell and the film's producers had been promised a reported $26 million budget by Capitol Films, which was a new production company led by someone without a Hollywood background and who was atrocious about sending them money to pay people. In total, Nailed would shut down at least 8 times during production because people were not getting paid. David O. Russell, because he would use a pseudonym on this, is not allowed to talk about this publicly, so details are scant. And by the way, this film has some pretty decent talent in it. The film has, like, Jessica Biel and Jake Gyllenhaal, who even back in 2008 were still relatively known. Like, Jessica Biel, wasn't she on, like, Family of Five or Seventh Heaven or one of those? Like, these were known people, and Jake Gyllenhaal's a Nepo baby. Like, it's not like they got, like, random people off, like, a Hollywood street corner trying to be actors. Like, this had, like, real talent in it. They had a $26 million budget, for goodness sake. Allegedly. Capitol Film blamed the constant shutdowns on the 2008 financial collapse, but the filmmakers believed that the production company was doing this intentionally to just kind of put a squeeze on them. The infighting led to the producers holding the film negatives hostage, and they even postponed shooting a crucial scene in the film until the very last day of shooting. The film's plot crutches on Jessica Biel's character getting injured via a nail gun to the head, and the film could not be told without this scene. It's literally the inciting incident, so they felt confident they could keep the money flowing so long as that scene remained unshot. The money problems endured to the point that one of the unions pulled their contract with the production, and as a result, filming was halted before the nail gun scene could be shot. Capitol Films filed for bankruptcy in 2010, with the film still unfinished. Somehow, in 2014, indie distributor Alchemy acquired a version of the film, which they had renamed Accidental Love. This version had reportedly been assembled by a former Capitol executive who'd used, quote, digital magic to create the major missing scene. It looks really stupid, and you can tell that's what they did, and you can find it on YouTube pretty easily. Just type in, like, accidental love nail scene, and there's like a 15-minute video, but you see it in there. It's real dumb. And I mean, the premise of this film wasn't great to boot. It's literally about a woman who gets a nail stuck in her head and can't have it surgically removed because she has no health insurance, and the nail begins causing her to act erratically and weird and irrational. It's a little dumb. David O. Russell had zero issues getting his name taken off the film as they moved to release it, because duh. But unfortunately, the actors had to live with the fact that they're in this travesty of a movie that feels very much incomplete. You can tell this is not a complete movie. David O. Russell isn't the only one with a special pseudonym. Steven Soderbergh has used several over the years, including Peter Andrews, Marianne Bernard, and Sam Lowry. Soderbergh, in addition to writing and directing his films, often acts as his own cinematographer and editor. He doesn't apparently like seeing his name multiple times in a row on the credit scrolls or on the openings, so he started using pseudonyms for his various movie credits. For 2000's Traffic, for example, Soderbergh wanted to use the credit photographed and directed by, but the Writers Guild has rules about where the writing credit falls, and this caused a problem because photographed and directed is not an official credit. So to get around this, Soderbergh decided to use the pseudonym Peter Andrews. I don't know how he got around it, but that was the reasoning, is that he could do that. And that was his father's I see what happened. So basically, if you're going to say photographed and directed, they also needed to put writing, because writing needs to appear before the cinematography. I think that's how that works. And because writing was being omitted from the credit, it was a breach of protocol. But if a different person, quote unquote, wrote it, then it's like a loophole. I'm pretty sure that's what he did. Soderbergh has also used the pseudonym Marianne Bernard, his mother's maiden name, for his editing credits, starting with 2002's Solaris. At times, Soderbergh has also used Sam Lowry as his writer's credit. The Coen brothers, Ethan and Joel, have a pseudonym for similar reasons, as they typically direct, produce, write, and edit their films. They also don't like seeing their names multiple times in the credits, so they decided to use the pseudonym Roderick Janes for their editing. Roderick Janes has been nominated for 2 Academy Awards, one for Fargo and the second for No Country for Old Men. If Janes ever wins an Oscar, he won't actually be the first fake person to win one. That distinction goes to Ian McClellan Hunter, aka Dalton Trumbo, who wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's. Trumbo had been a member of the Hollywood 10 during the HUAC trials, and when he won the Oscar in 1952 for Breakfast at Tiffany's, he was completely blacklisted from working in Tinseltown under his own name. Trumbo managed to continue working via this pseudonym, as well as the pseudonym Robert Rich, who would also win an Oscar for Trumbo with The Brave One. Trumbo was officially awarded his Oscar for The Brave One in 1975, just 1 year before his death, and posthumously for Breakfast at Tiffany's in 1992. Alan Smithy has also been used outside of the film industry, and it continues to be used in media and film projects that are not under DGA agreements. Although the pseudonym was intended for use by directors, Alan Smithy in total has been credited 138 times outside of that field. 44 times as an actor, 32 as a writer, 21 as a cinematographer, and 17 as a producer and editor. He was not the first pseudonym to be used in Hollywood, but he certainly got the most robust resume. So yeah, that's a little history about a guy that no one was ever supposed to know about. The worst director that never lived. The identity of Alan Smithy has now been revealed to you. So the next time you look up a director on a bad film and they don't seem to exist, you may be taking in a film from one of the children of Mr. Alan Smithy. Also, I rarely say this, but don't watch that Alan Smithy movie unless you want to lose IQ points. It was truly horrific. And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I also post photos for each episode at Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee, and I remembered to look at my emails. And the one I kept forgetting was Laura. Laura, thank you so much for the coffee. And I also have a new one, another one. Jason, also thank you for the coffee, which was also 2 weeks ago. That is how horrific I am at looking at my emails. I do it. It's just, you know, I'm busy. I've also got merch. Check it out. The link in the show notes. Next month, I'm going to do a first and totally lean into a trend right now because the one-off episode about this person is blowing up and I'm going to fully lean into her newfound notoriety and do a big month. You learned a little bit about her a couple of years ago, but next month we're going to do a full retrospective into the life, career, and legacy of Hollywood's original It Girl, Clara Bow. Clara Bow. Don't want to piss off that guy who gave me a bad review because I pronounced it wrong. Also, I'm going to check and it will be said right in the thing and I will take no notes on it. But yeah, if you don't like it, blame Taylor Swift. She's an easy person to blame for shit. But yeah, I've got a stack of books waiting for me to start doing this. I'm excited. And yeah, thanks again for listening. And until next time, that's a wrap.